We always talked about if we ever opened a place, we wanted it to be a real New York club. We wanted it to feel like a club for New York in the time that it existed and was not harping back to a better time. Older heads would be saying, oh, you know, it's not as good as it used to be, which is why we call the place Nowadays. It was like, this is the only time we live in, right? We got to make the most of it. So right now, right here is what it's all about.
You are listening to Centerpiece NY, where you can tune in to the many frequencies of the great city of New York through the life stories of people in their own words who have come from afar to live here. If that's what you're looking for, well, you've come to the right place. This is Paul Finnegan, the creator, producer, chief marketing officer, and the presenter of this thing. Here in the 10th and final episode of Season 2, we will get to know Eamon Harkin, originally from Derry in Ireland, who has achieved celebrity in the world of DJs and is taking dance culture and its community to a whole other level in Queens, the biggest borough in the city and the one that is not so outer borough anymore. By the way, I forgot to mention, and regular listeners will know this, our centerpieces are generally people from Ireland who have put down some serious roots in New York. Eamon Harkin is one of the few people featured in this series that I did not know personally prior to our recorded conversation. And he's the only one that hasn't developed connections of note to the Irish scene in this city, at least not yet. How I got to know him is a bit of a tale, but worth hearing, if I may say so. For reasons I don't need to go into, during the first few months of this year, 2022 that is, I found myself driving through an area of Queens and Brooklyn just before 7 a.m. each Sunday morning, passing through sections of the neighborhoods of Ridgewood, Bushwick, and Bedford-Stuyvesant, to be more precise. Even in the city that never sleeps, early dawn at the weekends can be a drowsy, dreamy, more peaceful time. The route I would take was off the beaten path, so to speak, through a post-industrial landscape of shuttered, defunct factories and of low bridges with rail tracks to carry freight trains to the grungy nether regions of this concrete jungle. At this ungodly hour, the many auto body shops on every block are silent, for once not jarring the eardrums with the stochastic din of pneumatic tools. And graffiti, colorful, ornate, and inscrutable, covers everything. On the occasional Sunday morning, taking the sharp bend on Cooper Street, I would come upon clusters of young adults loosely scattered around the small door of an old, nondescript, mustard-colored brick building. They were clad, somewhat scantily for the cool temperatures, I felt, in loud t-shirts and cut jeans and other flamboyant attire. There were lots of tattoos, ear and nose piercings, and a rainbow of hair dyes. I am loath to say that when I first saw these kids, I thought they might be up to no good. In time I learned I could not have been more wrong. But each time I witnessed them, my curiosity grew. And then, on one drive-by, I noticed a sign protruding through a tree, not on the building, but nearby. It was partially obscured by foliage. On it was the word, Nowadays. I had to know more. I pulled up alongside one youngster, lowered my car window and asked her what was going on. Her answer was a single word, delivered with a measure of incredulity, as if I should have known. Nowadays? It was time to Google. Nowadays, Queens, Brooklyn. I instantly found a website that told me that the building was a dance space, with an indoor and outdoor dance floor. Further investigation ensued, and without revealing my investigative techniques, I discovered one of the proprietors of the establishment was Irish. Bingo. I reached out via email, and very soon Eamon Harkin was game for being a centerpiece on Centerpiece NY. So that's how I found Eamon. This is why I love driving in this city. You never know what you'll find. I have in the past referred to New York as having cities within cities, places steeped in their own local histories. There is always so much to discover. Did you know that the breweries of Bushwick once brewed as much as 30% of the nation's beer? I could go on. New York is one of the very few places in America where you can survive without a car. But without a car, you only see the tip of the iceberg of this metropolis, because the subway doesn't go everywhere, and my only comment on the city's buses is, forget about it. Now, I will allow that a bicycle can often be as effective at getting to truly know New York as a car is, and increasingly it is becoming a bike-friendly town. But I still prefer my car. On a related note, to learn more about the location of the many fabulous neighborhoods of New York City, I put a link to a fascinating map in the show notes on the companion website for this show, centerpieceny.com. You'll also see some pictures of nowadays and its environs, and throughout this episode you'll hear Eamon's own dance music compositions. Eamon's story takes us from the troubled streets of Derry in the 70s and 80s, over to a hopping London in the 90s, then on to New York, to a city in shock in the wake of 9/11, to the gradual rekindling of its cultural fires, and now to its re-emergence from the virus. It is also the story of a persistent inner voice that refused to be smothered under the weight of practicality and sensibleness, and of finding a way to hear that voice, and making music the medium for bringing that voice to life, with all the risks and leaps of faith that that entailed. And so, as is the way of Centerpiece NY, it is in the Derry of 5 decades ago that we begin. Right, Eamon. What about ye?
Okay, Eamon, tell me about your upbringing, basically the whole childhood package.
Sure. So I was born in 1976 in Derry, in Northern Ireland. And I grew up as a child through the 80s, with certainly the Troubles as a backdrop. My mum is from the Brandywell, and my dad is from close to Rosemount, which are two neighbourhoods that are adjacent to the Bogside in Derry. So the Bogside is the, sort of the more known, deeply nationalist Republican area of Derry that was the site of Bloody Sunday and where Martin McGuinness lived, and kind of the area that I think for large parts of the Troubles the British Army couldn't go into. You know, it was really like the sort of ground zero for the IRA. So the Free Derry Wall, the famous wall, is right there in the Bogside. My mum would have lived like 10 minutes from there. My dad probably went more like a 20-minute walk up the hill. You know, they marched in Bloody Sunday. They marched for their civil rights. They were more directly affected by the discrimination that was in place when Northern Ireland had autonomy for direct rule, when the unionist majority was gerrymandering districts and discriminating in ways that meant the Catholic vote wasn't getting properly represented, and that had big impact on employment and opportunity in general. They felt that in a much bigger way than I did, you know, because things evolved from there and governance of Northern Ireland was taken back to London. My parents worked hard and, you know, created a more middle-class experience for us and my siblings. And we moved then to, you know, the suburbs of Derry. I mean, it's still a 10-minute drive to the city center, right? But it's still, you're not living in the middle.
What were your parents' names? Are they still with us?
Yeah. They're still living in Derry in the same house that we grew up. My dad's Frank. He's retired now. He was an architect, basically an architect by training. He never went to university as a young man. Because of a lack of opportunity at the time. So he ended up working for a local architecture firm, quite a famous local architecture firm. He'd done some famous stuff around Derry. he would sort of do a lot of the work, and his boss would have to sign off on it because he had the license or whatever. And then in later life, he went to university at the University of Ulster. He kept that dream alive and realized that eventually. And actually, we both graduated the same year, which was nice. He's a very, very creative man. I think the creativity that I have comes from him, although he's not necessarily a music fan, but he's very creative visually, a very thoughtful person in general about the world. My mom, his name's Barbara, she was a hairdresser from 15, left school 15, you know, went into local hairdressers, trained, was a hairdresser up until she had me. And then she took a period of years off, probably about 8 years, I think. I think she went back to work when I was 8. She started her own business at that point, basically going into the, I mean, we call them the old people's homes, which is probably not the that's what's kind of stuck in my head because I haven't really sort of considered
the assisted
them.
Living facilities.
Yes. She would go in there and do their hair. And she really sort of carved out a little niche for herself doing that. And she loved it because there was so much community centered around those. And she'd come home with all the stories. And that really, you know, brought her to life. And she did that for many, many years. And I think I get that sort of sense of community from her. And I also think I probably get the initial spark for music from her because she was always going out to see the show bands back in the day and to this day still loves to dance. So I think the initial memories of hearing music in the house are in the car where her playing her tapes.
You were the eldest?
Yeah, I'm the eldest and I have two sisters and a brother who all live in London. One of my sisters and my brother are twins. My sister Julie is a couple years younger than me and then Kieran and Claire, the twins, are a few years behind her. So, you know, we lived in a relatively smallish house, you know, all on top of each other, but very happy. I'm the eldest. The next sister down is Julie, and she lives in London, and Julie is a casting director in TV and film. She casts a lot of big TV and movie stuff, most notably, and recently she did the casting for a HBO show called I May Destroy You. And was nominated for an Emmy. I actually went to the Emmys with her, which was a blast. So she's doing great and obviously is in a very creative field. Then the youngest are Kieran and Claire, who are twins, and they're also in London. Kieran works, he's kind of got his feet in two areas. He works in animal welfare and is one of the leading experts on the illegal trafficking of tigers in Europe and works to address that. And then he also started his own charity recently called Get Out, which is aimed at getting kids in the inner city into nature and particularly to the like the seaside on the coast of England and into the ocean and surfing. And he runs a farm in East London where they can go and do farm related and gardening related projects and stuff. And that's really starting to take off. And then my sister Claire just had her second child. So she's taken a break, but she is a buyer and has been a buyer in the retail world for a while. So we all have pretty creative occupations at this point, I think, and they're all pretty entrepreneurial and sort of independent. And, you know, my dad towards the end of his career was working for himself. He had his own architecture office. My mom obviously started her own business. So we have this sort of self-sufficiency, I think, which is probably born out of, you know, I need to either do that or do nothing, you know, like my parents came from a time when that opportunity wasn't necessarily there. And so you had to be creative. So yeah, that's the gang. I went to St. Columb's College in Derry, which is famous for being the school that both Seamus Heaney and John Hume went to. So for a moment there, we had two Nobel Prize winners, which I think we might've been the only secondary school or high school in the world that had that. Obviously there's a lot of pride around that. It was, you know, run by the Catholic Church, all boys. It wasn't a particularly happy place for me, to be honest. Particularly in the early years, I really, really didn't like it. I kind of ended up in a class without any of my friends from primary school. There was a little bit of bullying that was going on. In retrospect, I wouldn't say it was particularly excessive, but it did affect me. And I kind of became one of the nerdy outsider kids. And for the rest of my teenage years, had a small number of tight friendships we were into indie rock music and art and books and studying, and we weren't really troublemakers or out on the streets, you know. I left Derry at, I just turned 19 to go to college. So for those teenage years in Derry, I was a really good student, and I developed a strong interest in music, and particularly like contemporary indie music, and grunge was big at the time. You know, it was the time of Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and all those bands out of Seattle. My children are young, but I think about the idea that at some point their peers become a big influence on them. A big influence for me was my best friend. It's still my best friend to this day, who was very, very passionate, but also very talented musician, and has gone on to have a really big career in music. And he really left an imprint on me because to him, the sky was the limit. He didn't really see any roadblocks in his pursuit of going out and following his dreams. And we would spend a lot of time playing guitars and listening to too much U2, I would say, which is probably not uncommon for a teenager.
Not at that time, anyway.
In the early 90s in Ireland, particularly because this is pre-internet, you know, so you're only really getting what's fed to you. In Derry, there wasn't a lot coming through. You know, there was like two CD shops, basically.
Can you tell me who the friend is that has a career in music, a big one?
His name is Johnny McDade, or as I know him, John McDade. He's a member of Snow Patrol, and he is one of Ed Sheeran's writing partners. So he is a busy guy, really, at the higher reaches of the commercial music industry. You know, he's the same person that I knew when I was 13, you know. He still is down to earth. He's got a thicker Derry accent than I think I have. He still plays with the band. He still loves music. He still always thinks that, you know, nothing is impossible creatively. He left at 16 to go to London. He's like, I'm going to be a famous musician. I'm out of here. I don't need to finish school. I was a bit too sensible for that. Also, I didn't have the talent. You know, he was a very talented musician, and I would bash about on a bass guitar, but he was an amazing singer. He just had that sort of latent talent that I knew I didn't have. There's one other anecdote about Derry that I wanted to share because I think it's relevant is, when I was at school, we would go out on work experience where the school would arrange for you to go and just go to some local business and spend a couple of days just absorbing, maybe, you know, do some filing or make yourself useful. And I went to a local music community center called the Nerve Center, where John O'Neill, who was the guitarist and songwriter in the Undertones, was working. And I spent 2 days with him. And that was another kind of formative experience of just sitting and listening to stories of somebody from Derry who'd gone out into the world and done something in music and done something pretty significant. That, alongside my friendship with John, I think were really instrumental in sowing a seed about a life in music, although it would take me a while to come back and realize that. Those were the moments and the relationships that I think were really relevant down the line as I eventually found my way to working in music. So I knew I had to like keep the head down and do the sensible thing, which was, you know, finish my A-levels and go and get a degree. But when it came to choosing where to go to get that degree, I went to London. I was strong academically. I could have pretty much went anywhere. I had a place in Trinity. I had a place most of the colleges across the UK. But there was also good options in London. London had the additional attraction of my friend John was there, and there was just all this exciting culture, exciting musical culture that the other places didn't really have. So I think the excitement of that was the impetus to go.
And that would have been early to mid-90s, is it?
95.
Before we leave Derry, for the time being anyway, Derry Girls.
Oh, yes. So Derry Girls, the era in Derry Girls is the same era that I'm talking about. And those girls are the same age that I was. So, because I think the writer of Derry Girls is my age. you know, I watched that show and I know all those stories so well because they match the era.
There's this background noise of the Troubles, as they are known. In your formative years, it did enter a very nasty phase, you know,
yeah.
But it wasn't the same huge kind of thing it was in the early 70s. So I was just thinking, as I'm listening to you, I didn't even think of Derry Girls until we started talking. I'm thinking, this sounds like you were having your own crack within your circles while this other stuff was going on a bigger level all around you. And I just got that impression from Derry Girls watching it, that these girls were living their life no matter what, you
right.
know, and there was lots of fun and adventure and ups and downs, obviously, but you were going through that as well, even though this was going on
yeah.
in the background.
You know, the backdrop of the Troubles was very much there. You know, I have memories of bomb scares, I have memories of actual bombs, I have memories of actual shootings that I've seen. My sister saw an RUC man get shot dead once. You know, it was kind of within our psyche, but certainly, you know, sort of a generation removed from the experience that my parents had, which was much more intense. The school I went to was the Catholic boys' grammar school. You had to pass the 11 plus to get into that school. The girls are from the Catholic girls' grammar school, which is run by the nuns. It is called Thornhill College. And the uniform they've got in the show is the uniform. So it very much is that school where my sisters went. And so, yes, if it was called Derry Boys, it would be me. I knew those girls. I know the characters very much so, yeah.
So you went to study in London. What were you studying and where did that take you?
So I studied chemical engineering and then I did a master's in biochemical engineering. So it's more of a right turn on my career in music than it is a gateway. The reason for that is, you know, there was a tension there when I was a teenager. I was a very good student. I was at a school that was very strong academically, and it had a real bias towards the sciences. And it was a time when there weren't a lot of role models and there was no internet. And so when you were making decisions about what to do, you were just kind of looking and seeing a certain direction presented to you. At the same time, you're sort of like, you're dreaming and you've got this friendship with somebody who's just dreaming big and is full of belief that he's going to make it as a musician. And you're very attached to that and you want something like that. But you also realize, you know, I can't sing. I can't play guitar like that guy. And so you're seeing a sort of limitation, or you're perceiving a limitation. And so he went to London and I just got the head in the books and did very well my A-levels and looked and saw there's a good living here in this thing called chemical engineering. And so I went to London and got into it. And I think I realized after about a year of it that this will be a good degree to have, but this is not what I want to do, but I can do it. Otherwise, I'm really enjoying being in London, experiencing everything that London has got to offer. And it was also a time when, you know, the government was paying for my degree. It was free education, but you only got one shot at it, you know? I remember thinking for a moment, rightly or wrongly, oh, you know, what if I did want to do something else? And there's kind of barriers to that, you know? It was like, you've picked your slot, you got to go for it because you're getting this for free. So I kind of just put the head down and did it. But simultaneously was out and about in London, consuming the culture that had enticed me there in the first place. And I was getting a real taste for an urban music scene, not only with like guitar music, because John was there and he was playing in bands and I was going to see him and it was, you know, very much in amongst that. But I also started to understand the culture of record collecting and DJs and DJ culture and dance music culture. This was new to me because I hadn't experienced it in Derry. Even though there was stuff going on in Derry, it wasn't very appealing to me. But I started to go to record stores, you know, bought some turntables, and I started to realize that there was this whole world of the music industry where there was these sort of like non-musician musicians or non-musician DJs or people that were, like, had found a way to make a life in music that was
DJing or running record stores or running record labels or always digging through records and collecting records. And so I started to throw myself at that as a hobby, right? As a way of kind of satiating the musical itch that I had. And just kept doing that. I graduated and I did an engineering internship for 10 weeks and decided that I really didn't want to be an engineer. The internet was just starting to like be a thing, and I got a job for Barclays Bank in their technical graduate program, where they were taking in science, engineering, and computer science graduates and training them in technology. And there was an interest there. It was like, oh, you know, I recognized this internet thing was interesting and it could go places. And so I sort of threw myself into that, took that job, and became a computer engineer, became somebody that was building sort of internet connectivity systems for this big business that was expanding and building up its, you know, its internet presence. And at the same time, I'm like, you know, I've started to DJ. I'm like playing out in small bars. I'm loving it. I'm doing it as much as I can. I'm buying a ton of records. I'm heading in that direction. And then when I was 26, Barclays said, hey, we're doing a big expansion in New York. Do you want to go out and build the system? And I was like, yeah, I mean, hell yes. New York, I'd never been. It always held this mystical, romantic place for me. You know, through the 90s, it definitely felt like America was still such an exciting place. And as an Irish person in London, sometimes you didn't feel all that welcome. The last big bombing campaign the IRA did, I think, was Canary Wharf in like 95 or 96. And I was there. I remember people saying things to me at university and, you know, mutterings, and there was always a little bit of, you know, sort of poking fun and sort of saying things about your Irishness that probably wouldn't be acceptable these days. So there was always a little bit of the hangover of, you know, it wasn't so long that, you know, was it no blacks, no Jews, no Irish in the guest houses in London? So we're probably...
No blacks, you know, no dogs, no Irish, was it?
Right. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
By the way, I worked in London in the early 80s.
Okay.
So you'd know better on the construction sites. Yes and no. But right. definitely you didn't go around shouting you're Irish.
Yeah.
Not like in this town. But
right.
Anyway.
Right. And so there was definitely something exciting just generally about New York. Musically, as I've been getting into this world of DJing, I've been studying the origins, and so many roads led back to New York. You know, this is a place where like David Mancuso started the Loft, which is kind of the original disco. It's the place where disco was really kind of born. It's the place that had all the big seminal nightclubs in the late 80s into the 90s. So many of the legendary figures in terms of producers and DJs were all New York characters. Then you had, you know, punk rock started here. You had hip hop started here all around the same time. And then coming into the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, there was contemporary music that I was buying that was coming out of New York. Like I was still a big guitar music fan. So I was enthralled with the Strokes. And they were like the hottest band at the time from New York. There was LCD Sound System and James Murphy and his record label were doing super cool things. So I was sitting in London, like reading about all this stuff, looking at this stuff that was coming over real time across the Atlantic, and just also like sort of being socialized into thinking that New York is the wonderful place for Irish people, a wonderful place for just generally to go. And somebody said, do you want to go there for 6 months? And, you know, so obviously I went. But it was 6 months after 9/11, and I was working in an office that overlooked Ground Zero. It was still a really wonderful time, but it was also, I could sense a sadness in the air. I was working with people that were there. That was kind of weird, you know? It was strange. It took me a minute to adjust. And I also think the New York I got was not the one I expected. And I've only really kind of realized this sort of in retrospect, that it was 6 months after 9/11. Like, there's no way I was going to walk into all the big parties
and all the big music events and all the like excitement that I had in my head. Like the city was in trauma. I didn't quite realize that at a time. I mean, I was being sensitive, I think, to my coworkers, but I was going out and not finding things and I didn't really put the pieces together. But I still loved it. And then I came back, and then a few months later they said, do you want to go back on a permanent basis? Build a team that's going to run the thing you just built, and we'll sponsor your green card and so on. It took a minute to think on that, but I decided to go for it because I didn't think I had much to lose. I felt like I was in a little bit of a rut in London, and I thought to myself, if it doesn't work out, I'll just come home, you know? And my mom said to me, how long are you going for? And I said, a year. And she still reminds me to this day of that fact. And that was 2003. So that's coming up on 19 years ago. When I landed in New York on a more permanent basis, sort of getting a footing in the city, getting somewhere to live and so on, and I'm working pretty hard at the day job, but I'm realizing, you know, the only people I know are the people I work for. And as wonderful as they weren't the folks that I wanted to spend time with at the weekends, or they weren't interested in trying to find the kind of experiences that I wanted at the weekend. It was a difficult period of being very lonely and struggling to connect with people outside of a work relationship, and struggling to find the things that I was hoping to find, because I still think New York was still in this traumatized place post 9/11. You know, and I was pretty close to going home. There's kind of two things I think happened. One, I met my wife, God bless her. Although we were friends for a while before we became romantically linked, but she was a good friend, a companion to do the things that I wanted to do. I would say, you know, I've read about this party on a boat. Do you want to go? And she'd be like, sure, we'll go, you know? And we would go and be the only two people there. And I'm like, right, well, I'll find a better one next time. But, you know, she was up for just going out. I mean, she's Canadian via North Carolina, but had a similar romance in her head about New York. So we kind of met at a time when we both wanted to go out and experience New York and find the New York that we dreamt about. You know, I was still having this sort of dissonance in my head about, what am I going to do? I don't really want to do this computer stuff for the rest of my life. And I had this kind of moment where I was like, well, you know, the thing you've been doing for years, when you go right back, you've always been doing something musical. And you sort of see some direction here with this DJ culture. Why don't you just throw a bunch of energy at that? And I did. And I made like a, you know, a mix CD. And with Martina, my wife, we went out and I just gave it to everybody and hustled and introduced myself and asked for gigs. Started then to get into a groove of being a working DJ at the weekends in New York. You know, I'd have one or two gigs a weekend, sometimes gigs during the week, which would go late, which meant the day job was hard. You know, you'd be going to work on a few hours sleep, but felt like I was doing something that had a bit of direction to it and I was excited by it.
Your soul was getting fed for once.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We're talking now like 2004 into 2005. You know, when you're out there, like, you know, in New York, eventually when you're sort of in a scene or in an industry, you know, there's all the players, right? And so I was meeting everybody and forming relationships. And I eventually met, probably around 2005, maybe 2006, this guy, Justin Carter, who was working as a programmer and a DJ at a club in the Meatpacking District. At this time, I'd got a residency at a club that's now gone in Greenpoint. Or we kind of got to know each other, and then we said, well, you know, let's go for a coffee. And we met up, and we ended up talking about a lot of our frustrations with how the scene was in New York. It became clear that we shared the same frustrations and we had some of the same ideas of how to address them. And these were frustrations like dodgy club owners, not paying people, not being honest, only in it for the money, not in it for the culture, not in it for the sense of community, hiring people that are just not very nice or friendly and creating a bad experience and giving the whole culture a bad name. You know, this is also coming off the back of 9/11, when the whole scene, nightlife in general in the city, had taken a hammering, and also off the back of Giuliani.
That would be Rudolf Giuliani, the city's mayor from 1994 to the end of 2001. Always a scary guy, but these days really scary.
He had villainized nightlife as part of his crackdown on crime and had found these like archaic laws that were originally racist laws to prevent jazz dancers and jazz players from playing freely in, you know, probably the 20s and the 30s, called the Cabaret Law. He used that to shut clubs down. A combination of like oppression by government, 9/11, and just, you know, bad actors. The scene was not in a great place. And so he and I would sit and talk about this and be like, wouldn't it be great if we could just sort of like do something different that sort of like addresses all of these issues, you know, and takes away some of the toxicity and is more celebratory and joyful and exciting. And we decided we were going to try and do something about it. We started at a new club in Manhattan that we thought was going to be different. And we worked there for about 6 months and we realized it wasn't going to be different. So we stopped and we're like, okay, we got to just stop working with all these shady club owners. So we just went into Brooklyn and we could get on our bikes and we would just go around Brooklyn. We would just find warehouse space and loft spaces. And we would find a way of renting them for a day and a night. And we would just build a party ourselves from scratch. We bought a sound system. We figured out how to run a bar. We found a security team that we could work with who were super friendly. We did all the hiring of the bartenders. We hung lights and we were the DJs and we would book other DJs that were more well known than us as a way of also attracting people in. And we called it Mr. Saturday Night as a way of giving it a sort of like fun, whimsical name that was sort of ambiguous, but also more accessible than historically limited nightlife names or nightlife presentations. And we did a bunch of branding that was very, very much about fun and openness. And I think it resonated with people because they were otherwise seeing a scene that just wasn't very attractive to them. And we started to build a following and people would come out. And then we were presented an opportunity to do a daytime outdoor version of the dance party in Gowanus on a patch of land by the canal. And so we did that and we called that Mr. Sunday because we did it on a Sunday. It was during the day. So, you know, it's kind of like Coke and Diet Coke. And also like Coke and Diet Coke, Mr. Sunday became much bigger than Mr. Saturday Night. So this was all sort of building. Lots of people were coming out. It was clearly connecting. So we knew we had to take some risks, but we were so passionate about it and so believed that we were doing something for this culture that had been beaten up and battered, that was a culture that was a meaningful way of giving people connections. But to me, it was like, this is the most exciting thing that's happened to me. This is the culmination of a yearning and a searching for something, and it's happening in New York, and I'm 30, and I just want to keep doing it. I was prepared to take those risks. And so we just kept the head down and kept doing it.
And now, a word from our friends at the Celtic Irish American Academy in Galway.
My name is Brian Fahey, Director of the Celtic Irish American Academy. I would like to invite you to join us on our next programme, which takes place in Salthill, Galway from July the 10th to the 23rd, 2022. Our two-week immersive summer programme for high school students is now enrolling. Come join us on this wonderful adventure in a classic Irish setting.
This is Caitlin from Parkland, Florida. In July 2019, I attended the Celtic Irish American Academy as an emerging Irish American young leader, fully immersing in the culture and heritage of Galway, Ireland. We stayed with an outstanding host family for 2 weeks, touring and attending classes on leadership, business, and volunteering. The memories I have and the friendships I made will last a lifetime.
For more information, visit our website at CelticIrishAmericanAcademy.com. And now, back to Centerpiece NY.
Isn't it great that the Academy will be back in real life in Galway this summer after 2 years of pandemic-induced inactivity?
The Gowanus space was sold. It's now some really fancy condos. We went to Sunset Park, to Industry City, because that whole complex was just starting to be developed. And they enticed us in because they saw that we were this sort of like cultural phenomenon. And they were like, oh, you know, if we bring these guys in, it'll help put us on the map and it'll bring some people down. And so we went there and the party got bigger and we started our own record label. At this time, we were pressing a lot of vinyl and putting out music from local musicians in the city that were connected to the party. We were touring on the road. So in between doing stuff here, we would go all over the world to play and DJ as a duo. So things were really taken off and were really established. And when we were at Industry City, we were like, we need a plan for where to take this. We can't be at the whims of like 1 year lease here, 1 year lease there, you know, semi-legal space, legal space, and then it disappears. We need to like try and take some control of our future. And we tried to negotiate a longer lease with the folks at Industry City, but it didn't work out. And so we decided we should open our own place. And we spent a couple of years just looking around the city. We knew we wanted somewhere that had an indoor space plus an outdoor space. We wanted the indoor space to have windows because we didn't want it to be a dark club because we wanted it to be more than a club. We had these other interests, other cultural interests. And we also had a broader interest in the idea of community that extended beyond dance music. We wanted it to be multi-generational. We wanted children to be involved, to involve food. We wanted to involve talking. We wanted to involve movies. So we eventually found this place that we're sitting in right now, which was a former kitchen cabinet factory in Ridgewood, which is in Queens, a neighborhood over from Bushwick. It's like 30,000 square feet all the way to the back. We took a lease on 6,000 square feet on the front, and we took the parking lot. We had enough capital of our own to build the outside. So we tore up the parking lot. We worked with a landscaping company to basically build a park. So we planted a bunch of trees, ran a bunch of electrical, put in a food truck, a bar, bathrooms, a dance floor, put up some lights. And we opened it in the summer of 2015 as just this outdoor beer garden where we then moved our daytime Mr. Sunday party into.
Whatever you need to do. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for your patience and thank you for your choreography as you are entering into Mr. Sunday. I just need some active listening for about 20 seconds. We like to greet all of our guests every Sunday with the same reminder of the policies inside the party. Very simply put, zero tolerance for any violence, discriminatory language, non-consensual touching, leering, glaring, actions of that nature. The reason that we remind everyone...
You know, it started well. It established itself in Ridgewood as a neighborhood spot for families and people just to come to hang out and eat and drink and be in a quite an unusual place for New York. I mean, it's 16,000 square feet of outdoor space, like a private park. There's more space like that in New York than there was back in 2015. It worked and it was a home for the party. And then we had this indoor space and we knew we needed a lot of money to build this out, to be a fully functioning space, the kitchen and the whole works. In building the party, we'd built an email list over time with people subscribing to the emails and so on. And so we had this connection to this audience. And we just went out to that audience and said, we're building this indoor space. We need capital.
So you crowdfunded.
Yeah. It was probably one of the most difficult exercises that I've ever had to do. We needed about $2 million. We got to about $1.5 million. After a while, and then we just ran out of options completely. It was a really difficult time because we were carrying a lot of debt and we were carrying the cost of the lease, but we only had a business that could be open 6 months of the year outside. And so we were at this really delicate time where it's like, do we move forward or do we back out? And to move forward, we needed more money. We'd really kind of exhausted all our options. And then I found another Irishman who was a general contractor who was one of the guys that I had come across as I was looking for somebody to build the place. I was kind of interviewing him and getting proposals for him. I'm doing this simultaneously to raising money because I'm trying to bring it all together and make it happen. At this point, anybody that's doing any work, I'm asking them if they'll do it for free in exchange for ownership in the business, because I'm trying to get over the line. I'm asking woodworkers, I'm asking architects, I'm asking designers, I'm asking metal workers, I'm asking the guy that built the sign system. Like, you know, it's really just, it's going to have to happen that way. But I'm still short by, you know, several hundred thousand dollars. And then this Irish contractor said, I will do this job for cost. I'll take my profit off it if you give me that in shares in the business. And that was several hundred thousand dollars. He's a guy called Dave Dignam. He's also an artist. He's built a lot of bars and restaurants in Manhattan. He's built a few things up in Williamsburg as well. You know, he's a creative guy. He's also got big calluses on his hands and, you know, he's a real big pickup truck and real sort of contractor type.
What's the name of his company?
Beecce, B-I-C-C-E. God bless him. He did it. He now owns more of the business than I do. The way the shares are assigned, it's sort of designed to evolve over time as people get a return on their investment. At this point in time, he gets the biggest check at the end of the year. But, you know, he took a huge risk. Without him, it wouldn't be here. When the indoor was open and we could kind of join it to the outdoor and really like bring the experiences together, it was only then you could really get into the business of community building, because we were here open every weekend. That sort of started in 2017 and was going really well. And 2019, it really started to feel like it was this cohesive thing and people were coming here and going back and forth between the outside and the inside. Our residents were playing regularly and had been in here for a while. The staff members had been here for a few years. You're seeing lots of regular faces coming through. There's lots of friendships being made. As we were getting ready for 2020, I was like, this thing is going to go and this is going to become a really like meaningful place. And then, of course, you know, COVID hit and we had to shut the whole thing down. That was not fun at all, because at this point, it's quite a beast, you know, like particularly this time of year, there's 50 people rely on a paycheck here. We have, you know, 12 resident DJs that play here on a regular basis. We have some seasonal staff, but we have consistent, you know, full-time staff as well. There's a landlord, he relies on his rent. There's debt to be paid off. It was this machine that needed to be sort of slowed down. So it was really hard making sure that everybody was okay, worrying about the business, worrying about yourself. You know, I just had a daughter, like literally 3 weeks before it all happened. It was a real time of like, man, is this the end of the journey? You know, is this the end of the 16 or 17 years of like coming to New York and finding a path and the dream coming true and opening this place? And it just come together. It just clicked. And then this pandemic was going to undo it. We were in constant negotiation with our landlord. We weren't paying rent. But then you started to see the light at the end of the tunnel. People were starting to get vaccinated. They were starting to pass some relief for the arts in Congress. And so I sort of saw people were going to get vaccinated. We might get some government money. And that by the summer of 2021, so basically a year ago, we might be in a position to like actually start opening up again. And that more or less came about. From then until now, it's been just phenomenal. Like the need for people to connect and be in rooms together and have communal experiences, it's never been more palpable to me. And we're a place that can offer that. I think it's been very cathartic to so many people. It's very cathartic for me. And it's allowed us to get back and employing people and paying off our debts and get back to the work that we're doing. When we sat down with our landlord, who is one of the biggest landlords in New York City, he does all his negotiations individually, we agreed to pay him more money back than we felt we could if he gave us an option to extend our lease, which he did. But that option doesn't open up for another year. So we've got a little bit of risk there, but hopefully soon we'll be able to exercise that option and get another 5 years and lean into being here for a bit longer. But, you know, it's just another version of the problems we've had in the past. It's real estate in New York. If you don't own, there's always some sort of underlying threat of being moved along. So
a lot of the capital improvements you put into this space, what would happen to all that if...
The landlord owns them.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, any business, any restaurant that builds a kitchen or any store that goes in and does a bunch of carpentry,
the landlord owns that stuff, unless you pick it up and take it out with you. So, you know, that, there's a whole kitchen there with a hood, and, you know, we dropped this ceiling, we built these walls, we built that brick wall back there. I mean, all that stuff, that just belongs to him. It's just the way it works. I mean, we take out the sound system, obviously, and we take out the furniture and so on, and we take out as much as we could, but he would inherit that. I think the actual existential risk to us here is a company like Amazon, who are buying up a lot of warehouse space on the fringes of the city because they're trying to get stuff into people more quickly because everybody's just shopping from home. You know, I keep tabs with trends in the real estate world in New York just to sort of see this stuff coming and see if I can do anything about it from our perspective. And that seems to be what's happening. Although we're on a kind of a weird road. I don't know if it's so great for a bunch of big trucks to be coming in and out on that bend, and there's that low bridge over there. So maybe we're kind of in this pocket that maybe we'll be protected for a while. I hope so, because I think we're doing our best work. It feels like we're really building a legacy here. I would like to talk about the very specific idea of this place, which is coming out of that era in New York when post 9/11, post Giuliani, when nightlife and all the clubs were just kind of decimated. New York was taking a long time to sort of re-find its roots and build back up a culture and a scene that had been so strong through the 80s and 90s. You know, obviously we were doing our thing and that was part of that. But there were other parts of the city that were just looking to Europe as an example. We could see examples of bad copies of clubs in Europe. Justin and I always talked about how that just seemed like a missed opportunity because this is where it originated. And the original New York clubs really reflected the personality and the character of New York. So we always talked about if we ever opened a place, we wanted it to be a real New York club. We wanted it to feel like a club for New York in the time that it existed and was not harping back to a better time. Older heads would be saying, oh, you know, it's not as good as it used to be, which is why we call the place Nowadays. It was like, this is the only time we live in, right? We got to make the most of it. So right now, right here, is what it's all about. And that's why we give it the name Nowadays. So much of our decision-making about how we run this place is one of how do we make it a place for the New York of today? How is it a place for all New Yorkers, right? And so to me, this is one of the great things about New York. You know, the melting pot is kind of the cliche, right? But like, it is one of, if not the most diverse city in the world. There are so many different cultures coexisting at the same time. Sometimes just side by side, sometimes rubbing off each other a little bit, sometimes not. Sometimes just respectfully coexisting side by side. We wanted to be a club where those different types of people could enter into the same room and be together and experience something together and sort of a communal connection and maybe leave with a greater sense of our common existence in this city that maybe we don't get every day because even though it's such a diverse city, we do sort of sit somewhat in our own lanes, you know? Like I find I'm a white middle-class cis man and I find that I sometimes get frustrated that my experience is a little too white and middle-class. So I really want to break through those silos. And so we're like, how do we get to this sort of idea we have in our head of a dance floor that just has all this different representation? You walk into some of these parties and you just see it's not a majority white dance floor, first of all. And you see all sorts of people from a Hispanic, Latinx background. You see a large portion of the African-American community. You see different generations of people that have been dancing in New York since the 70s when the original discos were in existence. You just feel something different and you don't know who owns this place or who's behind it because it's just so multi-directional in terms of like the, you know, the types of people that are coming at you. So we work hard to have a broad, diverse representation across all our residents. We track and measure the background of all of the DJs that play here and everybody that works here. And we're always looking to make sure that we've got the right balance, and a balance that reflects the demographics of New York.
Do you get people coming in from all over the city?
We do get a lot of people from Bushwick, particularly a lot of younger people for the nighttime stuff. But we have all different types of music that gets played here. And depending on who's playing, you will get people coming from all over the place. The work just continues to always be sort of checking ourselves and looking at the dance floor and looking at that makeup and asking ourselves, is there something we should be doing to make this place accessible and open to different parts of the communities that exist in New York by partnering with people that are part of those communities or inviting them in and giving them the space to use. I very much think of ourselves at this point as a cultural institution, you know, not a MoMA or a Whitney, you know, of that kind of scale. The kind of work that we do to put culture out into the world and make it appealing to a wide variety of people is the same work. You know, and then how that's presented and priced and marketed and the staff behind it that control the experience of people coming in. That is the work. At this point, you know, the infrastructure is all built. It's really exciting to be doing that in a city like New York after a journey of 18 years.
Good at everything, huh, man? Oh, that's perfect.
I have a 5-year-old boy called Desmond and a 2-year-old girl called Bridget. My wife was conducive to Irish names, yeah.
And does your wife help you run the place, or she has her own career?
She has her own career. She works in publishing for Condé Nast, the operational side, working across most of the magazines there. But she's here often. I still DJ the Sunday party. We'll come together with the kids and then they'll head home around 5 o'clock, and then I'll stay to the end.
Where do you live? Do you live around here?
I'm in Bed-Stuy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Eamon's story is deeper and richer than I could have hoped for. I am fortunate to have come across him on my NYC travels. Who knew a guy running a place where people can come and dance could be so intellectually thoughtful and not just some grubby profiteer? He and his business partner and all who support them deserve recognition for creating Nowadays and all it is and all it will be. Finally, with this program, there's always the Irish thing.
So how would you describe your connection to your Irish identity?
My connection to my Irish identity is something that I am increasingly giving more thought to and feeling increasingly a yearning to recapture. You know, I've been on this journey for so long of heading out into the world to find something in pursuit of a culture that was not an Irish culture, or a culture that is really particularly big in Ireland, didn't have a lot of room for Irishness in it. And particularly coming to the US, I was aware, and I did have some experiences of coming up against the kind of romantic notion of the Irish struggle, and in particular, you know, republicanism. I didn't really want to have to deal with that. I didn't like it. I felt that it was just sort of naive and not true to what was actually going on. So I didn't pursue an Irish community at all in New York. You know, if anything, I sort of deliberately avoided it. The entire time that I've been here pre-COVID, I never went longer than 3 or 4 months between seeing my family or being in Ireland or London or close to, you know, my Irishness. And I've always loved going back to Derry and Donegal, where we would go on holiday as kids. And my grandparents are all from Donegal. So Donegal, there's a real part of me there. But I think partly because of sort of getting older, having kids, and also, I would say, watching Ireland change from afar has been really interesting and also quite emotional to see Ireland, well, Republic of Ireland, become much more tolerant and progressive and change in a really positive way, I would say. And then also just, you know, Northern Ireland is changing. We saw that in the recent election, you know, like there seems to be a sense there of just sort of letting go of the old orange and green kind of way of looking at things and sort of looking at each other a bit more. And also, COVID, I couldn't go over there, and then family couldn't come here, and I felt very isolated for the first time. Never really felt isolated in New York from my previous life because I was able to go back and forth a lot. I find my thoughts going back to Ireland more. I was there last year in Doolin for my brother's wedding, and then a week in Donegal, and it was glorious. I'm in a place now where I'm sort of searching for a stronger connection again. So I'm going for 3 weeks in August with the whole family. I'm going to Kerry for the first time, and then a week in Donegal with my parents. And my son is 5, but he's been to Ireland 3 times, and he talks about it, and he asks when he can go back. I want to grow that relationship that he has to Ireland, and of course his family. I want to spend more time there. I want to reconnect with it. You know, if there's ever a point in time when the kids are older and I have a bit more sort of financial independence, it'd be nice to spend extended periods there, I think. My brother has such a strong bond with Ireland. He goes back there all the time. All things aside, if he could choose to live there, he would just be in a thatched cottage in the hills of Donegal, surfing every day on a pint of Guinness at night.
Yeah, and protecting tigers.
Yeah, right, yeah. When the tigers are all taken care of, that's where he'd like to be. And there's a big part of me that feels the same. I mean, you know, I might get bored and I might want to sort of get out. You know, New York's, it's a concrete jungle, and sometimes you also just yearn for these sort of experiences of nature, and Ireland really provides for that as well. So I feel like I'm really searching for a connection again that is new, even a connection in New York to Irishness. We'll see where it goes.
Thanks for listening. As I mentioned, this is the last episode of Season 2. I'll be back in the fall. Don't forget to check out the companion website for this show, centerpieceny.com. That's centerpieceny.com. It's worth a visit because it is full of additional information on our centerpiece and his world. And then there's the back catalogue of episodes from seasons 1 and 2, in case you haven't been keeping up, and shame on you if you haven't. Actually, season 1 episode 6 takes a deep dive into Bushwick through the eyes of an Irish priest from County Limerick who has been in St. Bridget's Parish there for over 60 years. While you're on the website, please write a review or leave a comment. Feedback is always welcome. A special mention to sound engineer Lachlan Hart, imaging manager at News Talk Radio in Dublin, for his post-production work on this episode. Season 2, it's a wrap. Will we leave it like that? So, we will, sure look it.